The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 39. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I just saw an epic thread of his yesterday on Twitter regarding everything that's going on in the repo market with collateral, the bonds. He's a bond strategist. He's been in this business for 20 years. His name is George Goncalves, and he's right here, right now, on short notice. So, George, thanks for being on the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Yeah, great to be here, George.
All right. So, if just quickly for my viewers who might not know your background, can you fill them in on your story and how much experience you have in the business?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started out, in the late 1990s, really at the start of, really this liquidity bubble that we've been kind of living in through the last 20 years, where you've seen multiple kind of iterations of the Fed, producing new programs or easing to kind of keep interest rates going lower and lower. And each time, the tank looks like it's going to run dry, but it really, they always find the to pull a rabbit out of the hat. But, it started out in the late 90s on the buy side, moved over to the sell side, and basically was there for about 20 years working my way up through various research departments at all the largest banks that you could name. And, talking to investors from the U.S. all the way to anywhere out in Europe through Asia. So, really a pleasure to have had that experience and being able to kind of collect a lot of knowledge across different investor types, from central banks to hedge funds to large real money, and of course working at a bank and a dealer myself.
So I'm curious what your day to day looks like. Like, what does a bond strategist do?
I think we start our day like everyone else, kind of looking at all the key economic data. I mean, this past week notwithstanding, which has felt like more like a year than it has felt like a and every day has felt like a week to that,
yeah,
or a month, I should say. But we have everyone has their own style and techniques. I'm more of what you would consider a macro fixed income strategist that really kind of bottoms up, understanding the plumbing of the system, understanding how trades get executed, coming up with trade ideas yourself, spending time communicating those views with traders as well as clients. And, the flip side of what like an equity analyst would be or an equity strategist, it's the bond version.
Got it. So going back to yesterday, and that was Thursday, March, what was that, the 12th? What on earth happened? I mean, from a layman, I'm just checking my Twitter feed in the morning. Usually I look at the repo stats that they post on the New York Fed's website, and I saw that they did about $100 billion overnight, and then they did another $100 in term, but there was a lot that didn't get accepted. So oversubscribed by, if my memory serves me right, $74 billion, something like that. And I thought, okay, well, this is a big deal. And then actually on Twitter, I said, this is kind of feels like the fireworks that we saw back in 2008. But then no more than 2 or 3 hours later, I see on my Twitter feed from guys like you that the Fed upped it to $500 billion, another term repo. They were doing that day. Then they added another $500 for this morning and another $500. And it just keeps going up and up till the end of the day. They had $1.5 trillion. And I remember seeing Steve Leisman, and this was before it was up to $1.5, is only at a trillion then. And I almost felt bad for the guy. I always give him a hard time on my videos, but he was sweating and he was announcing that they went up to a trillion. And it was just such a crazy event that you could see the stress in his face and you could hear it in his voice. But what on earth happened yesterday?
I mean, to be honest, if you think about the actual numbers and it starts to like sound really big, it's really trying to drive home a message, trying to control the narrative, to be honest, to put this idea that we're creating a firewall, we're producing as much liquidity as necessary. But if you look at the actual stats and what we've seen in this last two term operations, they've been fractions of what people could have taken down. So the repo programs being large are there. If over the course of the next couple of weeks, there's a pileup of collateral on the dealer side, then they could take advantage of those larger numbers. They don't have to oversubscribe, so to speak. But I think that was really just optics. I mean, the Fed is virtually buying time. And then on top of that, they also shifted the QE with, or the not QE, out of T-bills, which if they had not done that, considering all the money that's flowing into money markets, they would start competing with the money markets for actual collateral themselves. And so you had this, the Fed finally got the message, and it's something I've been kind of writing about for a while now, they had to shift out the curve. I mean, you know, people thought, well, if they do that, they're going to acknowledge that they're doing QE. It's like, well, they're doing QE anyway, so let's just make it for real, move out the curve, and don't leave such a heavy footprint in the T-bill market, in the short-term securities, which, you know, people have been either raising cash, liquidating out of equities. Your first kind of port of call is the money markets, and they don't have enough short-term securities to buy like they used to. Right. So it was a smart move by the Fed, but they've done basically, they're basically in this kind of throwing the kitchen sink at it attitude. And, you know, look, it's starting to work in terms of clearing out some of the, you know, the kinks in the treasury market. But, you know, I think some of it was preventative. Some of it was just optics to say, look, we got this under control. We're doing a really heavy load of repo. I think that's not where the problems lie. The problems will lie with credit and other markets, which we can get into if you're interested. But I mean, treasuries themselves were starting to kind of also price in ways which were, you know, very atypical of how the treasury market usually operates. And that's really sacrosanct for them. That's like the key thing for them to keep super liquid.
Are those credit spreads between the, I think you talked about that, and I actually texted you last night about that. Very fascinating. I didn't even know that there was a difference between the two types of treasuries. We've got the on-the-run and off-the-run treasuries. I guarantee you 99% of my audience has no clue that there's actually a difference between the two. Can you explain that a little bit further?
It's almost like parallel universes. You have these two these two bond markets in a different dimension, but they're all kind of coexisting. You know, there's a series of now six on the runs and soon to be seven on the runs when they introduce a 20-year treasuries, most likely in May. But there's these points on the curve, which are the main kind of tenors, the main maturity points on the curve, which kind of people use to connect the dots and make a yield curve.
Right. Right.
Those are the benchmark on the run securities, which are issued mostly every month, and some are issued on a quarterly basis and then reopened as an old version of the new one. And these on the run treasuries are where most of the trading activity gets done for hedging, for macro bets on where you think rates are heading, how the curve is going to move. You use the on the runs because they're the deepest, most liquid ones that are actively trading every single day. Whereas the off the run securities are still treasuries. So at the end of the day, they're all money good.
And they're the same maturity.
They could be the same maturity, different coupons potentially, different interest rate levels. But over time, their prices will adjust for that. But they're literally another kind of parallel yield curve that's kind of overlapped with these benchmark securities. And they trade around them. It's almost like a solar system of the 10-year treasury is the sun, and the on-the-run 10-year treasury. And then all around it, there's like 10.5 and 9.5. And those securities that are around it are less liquid than the on-the-run.
All right. So that's why all of the entities that are often in the repo market, they put a premium on the on-the-run treasuries because of that liquidity, and they're just trading it back and forth with one another, as opposed to something that's far more illiquid where it's just sitting on the portfolio of some 75-year-old guy in Florida
or a pension that's, you know, multi-billion dollar pension or central bank globally or a bank portfolio in New York or in Chicago. It really doesn't matter. Those securities are there because there's more deep value and usually offer slightly higher rates, which over time helps from a compounding standpoint.
For sure.
And so, I mean, they're still a treasuries, and we don't want to, like, you know, put them on a separate plane altogether, but they're not the active trading. So when you see on TV that, you know, the 10-year treasury is moving up and down X amount of basis points, it is the on the run that's moving. The off the run could be actually moving more.
Okay. Okay, I got it. So whenever we see this on CNBC or Bloomberg, it's the on-the-run interest rate they're referring to.
Yep.
Okay, got it. And generally, what's the spread between the two? I mean, just like historically, is there an average?
Well, it depends, because just like the yield curve will give you different yield spreads between the 2-year and the 10-year. If it's a steeper curve, you have a different kind of spread. When the curves are very flat, you know, the spreads compress. And so we're talking about, you know, very few basis points, couple basis points here or there. But okay. when markets are operating and functioning properly, where there's a lot of liquidity in the system,
yeah.
when there's relative value investors that say, hey, if this thing gets out of line and it goes to 4 or 5 basis points higher than the same security, but just different treatment towards it, you know, people will come in and swoop them up and try to compress that spread. It's like a relative value.
It was an arbitrage deal.
It was an arbitrage deal, exactly.
Okay, so I was looking at a chart today on the one of the Fed's websites, and it went back to 2008 when we had the issue with Bear Stearns and Lehman, and they had what I think is the spread between those two for the 10-year, and it showed that it got up to almost 60 basis points.
That's right.
I mean, wow. So what did that spread get up to yesterday? Was it close to the 60? I read one report, I think on MarketWatch, that said that it actually got up to 50, but I couldn't believe that.
Yeah, so look, you know, when there's times of duress, those spreads can gap out tremendously, because what you are basically paying for, you know, without going into specific levels, is you're renting balance sheets. You're basically, yeah, you're renting the ability to park that security somewhere, and it's going to have to probably sit there for a longer period than the on the run, which you can get rid of in a heartbeat. Mm. And so when there's periods of either duress or balance sheet becomes very scarce, you're renting that balance sheet, and it comes with a more implied cost. You see that in how futures also don't have an inherent kind of footprint on balance sheets. They're a derivative of a treasury, and those, what it's called the basis, was also widening in a very, you know, to levels of those sorts. So when we get to periods like this, you can see a real differentiation between treasuries on the runs versus off the runs. And the last time, it's great that you went back and looked at that. The last real time that we had something like this was during the financial crisis, where
right,
it started to really, you know, blow out. And the Fed then came in and, of course, did QE. And now we're so used to QEs as if it's, you know, we're just administering more.
Yeah. And nonchalant.
Yeah. They're just going to do more QE.
Don't worry about it. Another trillion. No problem. So with the issue that we had yesterday and the lack of liquidity that we've obviously been having since on the short end, since September 17th, and it's just blown up now. I know I talk to Jeff Snyder every once in a while, and I follow him on Twitter. I mean,
he's great.
He's incredible. And his view on this is that it's more of a collateral issue than a cash issue. And in the video today, I went over that liquidity has two components to it. It's not just cash. People see that and just get fixated on it. But if there's no collateral in the system, it doesn't matter how many quadrillions of dollars are sitting in reserves at the Fed, it's not going to get out into the repo market. So do you have a view? Per your tweet thread last night, you've got a similar view to Jeff, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, so I agree with a lot of the concepts that Jeff has put out, as well as others that are really great, you know, have a great command in this sector. The thing that I try to do is straddle the middle, which is, it depends on who you're talking to. For the large major banks, it probably is more of kind of like a collateral thing. For the smaller banks that are really more liquidity deprived, like the liquidity haves and have nots, I mean, it's more about actual access to the cash. And I think really having the ability to have those, you know, LCR ratios stay high. And so I think it's, you know, the banking system is not one uniform entity. There's,
right,
there's different degrees of needs. And I think that the larger banks is a collateral story. And also there's the, you know, something that others have mentioned too, is that there's, you know, the connection back to the global dollar phenomenon and how, you know, we really have a U.S. dollar based in U.S. We have a euro dollar, which has been around for decades. And we have an Asia dollar. And those three dollars kind of are like a Venn diagram. They kind of overlap with each other depending on trading hours. And also depending on, you know, what has been issued in overseas markets. And so sometimes there's a collateral scarcity in the dollar markets out overseas, which then forces, you know, some major kind of shifts. And we started to see a little bit of that yesterday too. The euro dollar FX basis started to widen yesterday, which showed that there was a demand for dollars. And even today, the way the dollar was trading, it was looking as if there's, you know, beyond the balance sheet renting part, which is one component, there is a kind of a global dimension, which is a need for dollars. And I think that started to pop up today too, which is why the Fed's tools are not fully exhausted. They're going to probably do more next week, and we can get into that. But you know, the repo is really a domestic issue. I mean, of course, the foreign banks that are part of the repo, the primary dealer network, can use it, but it's more for the domestic, and it's more for treasuries and mortgages. And if we're going to have a problem in our fixed income markets, it's not going to be just there. It's going to eventually reverberate into credit and high yield, as we're seeing with spreads. So I think the Fed's going to do something much more creative.
Yeah. So the just real quick takeaway to summarize for the viewers, just so they can follow this here. So with the, there could be a collateral issue with maybe the bigger players, but the smaller players in repo, it might be more of a regulation issue with the liquidity coverage ratio or maybe Basel III. I think I saw Jim Bianco texting or tweeting this morning about how he was talking to some of the banks, saying that they'd love to take a piece of that trillion or 1.5 trillion that's been issued. But and we didn't even talk about that, but a very small portion of what they committed to, the Fed, actually got used by the entities in the repo market. So I think the first 500 only had 17 billion of demand. And Bianco was saying, from the people that he's talking to, it's more of a regulatory issue, that they'd love the money, but because of, I think it was the LCR, they just, and I'm not able to connect those dots because I'm not an insider, but that's what his point was. So that would be step number one. Then we're taking it to the, well, actually, do you have any thought? Am I getting it right there?
I think you're basically getting it right. I mean, it's, you know, there's the larger banks are obviously really watching their LCRs because they're actually they have to uphold those regulatory requirements. It's that the smaller players, if they take on additional repo, it starts to really alter some of their other financial ratios, so they really can't take advantage of it. And they might be also, because they have some capital that may have to, you know, put up against it as well. And also they might also not have all the collateral either, and there might be some collateral hoarding that's happening. So there's so many different dimensions. It depends on the entity that you are.
Right.
And I think that's why the repo tool itself, from the Fed's point of view, you can produce really large numbers unless there's a piling up of treasuries and mortgages over the next couple of weeks that would even reach 500 or a trillion. No one's going to really fully use those programs. That's the bottom line from my point of view,
right,
which means that it was more optics. Try to say, hey, we got this covered. We have an almost unlimited credit line has been given towards a repo function.
So it's more psychology than it was liquidity, potentially.
100%, because it's not being used as you've displayed, and there's just not enough collateral to even meet that target. I mean, it wouldn't happen.
So you also mentioned that you think the Fed has some more tools at their disposal. Just from an amateur like me, the only thing I see is just dropping interest rates or printing money to do quantitative easing or whatever they want to call it. What other tools do they have at their disposal?
Well, I mean, I think we can go back and hark back to the 2008 experience, and they might change some of the names that they use when they describe these tools, but they're going to basically serve the same purposes. The first and foremost one is still the discount window, which they could just say, look, bring everything you want to the window, and we're going to, you know, provide you cash on the other side. We're going to really relax some of the haircuts or the constraints of what kind of reduction in actual cash you get back for every single dollar of what you bring to the window. We're just going to relax some of those constraints because, you know, we're in a, you know, in uncharted territory with what's happening for corporate America, small businesses. You know, they kind of did that in the 1930s. They basically said, you know, just bring it to the window and we will, you know, if you're a money good entity and you have a good business model, there was actual credit departments scattered through all the regional feds, which were going through and saying, hey, that's an actual viable company. Like, that sort of activity was being done in the 1930s. So, So that the discount window is a very powerful tool. They'll try to take away the stigma of using it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's what Jeff talked to me about quite extensively, that it's just almost a moot issue now because of that stigma that I call it the walk of shame in my videos. But I don't know if that's you have a different opinion on it.
Well, is it relevant now when we're dealing with something that's a random unknown? And I think people will look the other way. If you're doing something because there's a airline industry or travel or something's happening where it's really being disrupted, they need the cash flow, it's a viable business, they'll be here in 3 months, but you don't want to run them out of business because there's no cash flow coming in. I think there's ways around that. And I think that could change. Again, that's also another optics narrative story spinning.
Yeah.
So discount windows one, but they can get even more specific and bring out the alphabet soup of programs, which they had the discount windows for the banks, but the dealers are probably going to be the places where a lot of these corporate bonds, if they start to be sold for whatever reasons,
yeah,
they can start, ending up on the dealer's balance sheets, and they can start, and if that could launch what is an equivalent of a discount window, but for the dealers, it was called the primary dealer credit facility, the PDCF, that might come back. And if you go back and look at the history, like basically a lot of different kind of collateral was being posted during 08 that, I mean, pretty much almost everything was being posted. I think even equities at some point were being posted. So I think, a very powerful tool, and that's still domestic and banks related. Then there's the overseas stuff, which we can go into, which is the dollar swap lines and things like that.
Okay, so just so I'm clear, so let's just say the corporate bonds right now, no one wants those because they're collapsing. They don't want to catch a falling knife. No one in the repo market wants those as collateral. But you're saying that the Fed in 08 or prior to that set up a mechanism where the primary dealers could buy that collateral that no one wanted, and they could pretty much do a repo swap with the Fed so that that collateral goes onto the Fed's balance sheet, and the Fed doesn't have a profit and loss, so they don't have to worry about how bad that collateral is. And then the reserves just get replenished in the account for the broker dealer. Am I following that?
That's 100%. They all work the same. All these programs, it doesn't matter what ends up happening. In the T accounting mechanism, the Fed will just,
absorb it,
and they'll deposit reserves in your account, and at some point, once things either settle down, the transaction is reversed, and then dealers are able to then either move into the warehousing business if they want to hold that paper, or sell it back into the markets when things calm down. So yeah, that's a powerful tool if we get to that point. And then there's maybe one more before the dollar swaps.
Yeah.
The commercial paper facility. There was also at one point that actual U.S. corporations were able to issue short-term credit basically through the Fed's basic balance sheet. I mean, it basically expands the Fed's balance sheet, and they were able to get source cash that way as well.
Okay, so. Before we get into the euro dollar stuff, before 2008, if you look at a chart of the excess reserves in the system, you're looking at, less than $10 billion, $10 billion with a B. Now you've got $1.5 trillion. I haven't looked at it lately. I'd assume it's even higher with what the Fed's been doing with their balance sheet. But you were in this business back then. So how did the repo market get funded with less than $10 billion when it requires over $1.5 trillion in excess reserves now?
Well, there was just a lot more leverage on the street. There was the dealers were able to actually take on more turns of leverage and then warehouse all that paper. And by the way, the market was a lot smaller. We've solved, in essence, a credit crisis from 08 with more debt. So now the debt is even larger. The corporate bond market is, more than doubled. The treasury market is, tripled, right? We have so much more paper now in the system that you kind of need the Fed as like this counterbalance to keep, all this, liquidity flowing through the system.
Yeah, the plumbing to keep it going. So it sounds like they've got a lot of tools, but the first thing that comes into my mind are what are the potential unintended consequences of this? Look at going back to 2008, they started quantitative easing. Bernanke said, oh, no problem. Don't worry about it. It's just temporary. It seems like everything is just temporary, whether it's income taxes or quantitative easing. Every temporary thing they do turns into something permanent, even back in repo September 17th. Remember, oh, nothing to see here. It's just temporary. Now, all of a sudden, they're doing $1.5 trillion in repo. So, I mean, you know this so much better than I do. What are the unintended consequences that might result of them using more tools than they're already using right now?
Well, the QE is the most powerful one of all of them because it's a permanent execution of adding reserves and they stay there. Yeah. Whereas these other facilities, in theory, should go back down. You're 100% right, though. The repo solution that was put in place kept growing and growing from September. Like, well, we're just going to start with this size. Oh, that's not large enough. They kept getting bigger and bigger. Now they've kind of created this dependency factor in order to keep it ongoing. And let's not make this is not just the Fed's doing, by the way. I mean, there's a lot of treasuries being produced in because of our deficit financing. Mm-hmm. And so someone has to buy those securities. The dealers are obligated, and you're creating at moments you need a relief valve.
Yeah,
and that relief valve is what the repo market the repo facilities from the Fed are allowing to do. Mm-hmm. That's one side of things, right? But if we get a worst case scenario tied back to an economy that's going into recession because of coronavirus or whatever fact, and it was already sliding for other macro reasons, if we're at a point where we're going to have to even double our debt or deficits per year from $1 trillion to $2 trillion, I mean, that's just a lot of securities that someone has to buy. And so the Fed, even today's actions, if you maybe got lost in all the shuffle and all the news, because there's been so many new announcements, it's hard to keep track.
Yeah.
But, as we started in the conversation, they went from 60 billion T-bills to now buying treasuries across the curve, not just T-bills. They did 37 billion on a Friday, almost half of what they're supposed to do for the full month in one day.
I didn't realize that. Wow. And just to put that into context, how much was quantitative easing every QE1 every month?
It depends on the mortgage versus treasuries. The treasury one was 30 billion per month initially.
Okay.
Just purely treasuries.
Yeah.
And then QE2 was 75. Yeah, 75, I think. So per month.
Yeah. So they did 50% of what they were doing in official QE. They did it today in just one day. Wow. Yeah. I had no idea. So yeah, where do they go for the rest of the month? Are they just tapped out?
This is where it gets really interesting, right? And that's why I bring up these big numbers around the deficits are $1 trillion and could go easily to $2 trillion in a recession. 60 billion really is a down payment. I mean, we can easily get to 150 billion per month on a QE program, close to, what is that, 1.8 trillion per year. It's completely doable, and it's something that might happen if we're really faced with a really sharp downturn. But just by them doing that today, it was under the guise of, And largely, I believe what they're saying is true. Because we discussed the price action in the on the runs and off the runs.
Yeah.
There's been, very little activity and very widening of bid offers. Like, so the price that people are willing to accept versus selling and buying. There's been market depth, or how much actual transactions are taking place. Have been falling all week long. This massive rally in the rates market has that. First, we saw rates get cut in half, and then now they've doubled again in a matter of a week. I mean, that has damaged the landscape in the bond market and has left all these off-the-runs kind of like almost like orphaned treasuries that are out there, and the Fed had to kind of mop it up and clean them up. So I think that's what they did today. They did like a cleanup operation to take out a lot of these securities. And that was a smart thing to do. But you're right. Now they've kind of gone through almost half of their allotment for the month. So what are they going to do for the rest of the month? They might have to increase the QE program.
Yeah, it just seems like there's such a big difference between doing what's quote-unquote right now compared to what would be right for the long term. a lot of times those are two completely different types of action. But yeah. if they're doing even more of this quantitative easing, which based on their definition means they're keeping it on their balance sheet for an extended period of time, and I'm going to let you go after this question because I know sure. that you're short on time here. I really appreciate it. But how do they unwind their balance sheet? And if they can't unwind their balance sheet, aren't they just monetizing the debt and going to that kind of banana republic mode, or what do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm not fully there yet on the banana republic mode. I mean, the U.S. is still the dominant power. We still have the largest military, and we have the dollar. I mean, those are two powerful forces that I think, you know, people are not going to mess with us on those fronts. And the Fed is really just executing that mission and that objective. So I think that's a really, you know, they're what they're doing so far now is market functioning type stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, is part of their mandate. And so that's something I'm not really against. What I am, I'm much more sympathetic to the idea of laissez-faire, you know, business kind of people should figure out how much risk they should take, and they should, you know, manage those risks and not always have to get bailed out. I'm 100% behind that view, but they're just too far. They're just too far in. I mean, when you have the balance sheet as large as you do, and you have a vested interest in this continuing to operate in this manner.
Yeah.
And so they're 20% of GDP. Other central banks around the world are actually even larger relative to their size of their economies. So the Fed has scope to easily, I mean, I've joked around about it, they can double their balance sheet and it would work. It would still work. I mean, at eight trillion, it would still work. I mean, it starts to kind of impact the functioning of the money markets. And that's a whole other topic that we ever get into. But they can easily double their balance sheet. And the unintended consequences will be, does that money then become inert? Does it sit in the system and just kind of fulfill obligations for regulatory needs? Or does it ever get remonetized and go back into the economy and create inflation?
And that's back in, yeah. And to be very clear for the viewers who aren't totally following the conversation, the Fed can print and create as many reserves as they want. They could print quadrillion reserves. And the reserve accounts are basically the bank accounts that the primary dealer banks have with the Fed. And in order for those reserves, that new money that's been printed, if you want to look at it that way, to get into the real economy, the primary dealer or the bank that's under the Fed's umbrella that has that reserve account has to take some sort of action. They have to create an additional deposit in the real economy by either buying a financial asset or creating a loan that increases the money supply. So your point is, yeah, they could take it to 20 trillion, 30 trillion, but the big question becomes, do those reserves get from the Fed's balance sheet somehow out into the real economy in the form of new deposits, increasing the money supply? We get an uptick in velocity, and then you're off to the races as far as the inflation genie. Then we got real big problems, because then the 10-year's going up, and if the 10-year goes up to a certain level, that's going to severely negatively impact the economy. But that's a whole other interview, George, and I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being here. For any of my viewers who want to find out more about you, where can they go?
I mean, for the moment, just at Bond Strategist. So just, you know, just spell it out, Bond Strategist, at Bond Strategist on Twitter. And I'm kind of working on a business plan, a business model, and I'll see where I take it from there.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you again for your time. I cannot wait to do it again.
Appreciate it. Thanks, George.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.